KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today we turn to a topic that we've touched on in the past, specifically with a few guests, and also talk about indirectly with a number of others. The topic is secrecy. Or perhaps sort of the other side of the coin, transparency. We've discussed secrecy in a variety of contexts early in the history of hearsay culture. We had Steve Aftergood from the Federation of American Scientists on discussing secrecy. We've also had a number of individuals on the show discussing issues related to privacy, which relate to secrecy. But we've never really had a show where we've specifically focused on secrecy, not only from a practical standpoint, but also as an academic discipline. And I'm very excited to have that discussion today with the person who is eminently qualified to have such a discussion. My guest today is Dr. Susan Marrett. Susan is a lecturer at the School of Library and Information Science at San Jose State University, and she is the editor, co-editor of a recent compendium of literature on secrecy, appropriately titled Government Secrecy, Classic and Contemporary Readings. Her co-author, Jan Goldman, is not joining us today, but I'll be referring to the book as Susan's for purposes of our discussion. In Government Secrecy, what Susan has done in her book is pretty much put together, as far as I can tell, most, if not all, of the major thinkers and writers who you might come across if you were thinking about secrecy in terms of how it's what regulation means, the history of government secrecy, how secrecy is affected in terms of its logistics, secrecy both pre and post September 11th, and so forth. And so the range of authors in government secrecy literally goes from Thomas Jefferson to more modern authors like Senator Patrick Leahy, a Democrat from Vermont. In Susan's book, other websites, for example, opentogovernment.org, are quoted. But in Susan's compendium, and were one to read Government Secrecy, I think that person would become almost instantaneously one of the most educated people in secrecy as a discipline, because having a personal interest in this area of secrecy, and particularly government transparency and how intellectual property law impacts government transparency, when I came across Government Secrecy, my eyes lit up. And I thought, this is what I've been looking for as a good, handy compendium of writing in this area. And I was familiar with many of the authors. Some were new to me, and I've learned a ton reading the book, and I think anyone interested in this area would be hard-pressed to find a more thoughtful compendium of authors to think about these issues. So what we're going to do today on Hearsay Culture, I'm not going to ask Susan questions like, please get in ahead of Thomas Jefferson. That would be one of my unfair questions, but that, to me, I think would be too unfair. Rather, today we're going to talk about not only the logistics of putting together this book, but really what we're doing with secrecy as both as a doctrine, as well as a form of regulation in the United States, and perhaps more broadly in 2009. Like I said, this is an area of particular interest to me because of my writing, and so for that reason, I'm very excited to have on Dr. Susan Marrett today on Hearsay Culture. Susan, thank you for joining us today on the show.
Well, thank you so much, Dave, and thank you for your kind and enthusiastic introduction to the book. It means a lot to me. Jan and I, Dr. Jan Goldman and I, put a lot of effort into this work to make it essentially a panoramic view of government secrecy. And so thank you, and it's a delight to be on the show.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time, and I mean it sincerely when I say that I was really excited to come across this volume, and I think it's a useful addition to the body of literature that exists in this area. Let's start off, Susan, with a question that I ask really all of the authors on the show, which is your background. I've given a very basic introduction, but perhaps you could talk about your background a little more deeply with a focus on how you became interested in government secrecy.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do so. Let me start by going back a few decades. I have a master's in library and information science from University of Arizona. I'm trained as a librarian. I have experience in government documents and as a reference person, and also a background in research literacy. I became extremely interested in secrecy. Of course, I didn't call it this back then. I think I probably thought of it as information restriction and not secrecy. But I actually became very active as a community member in environmental affairs when I lived in Arizona. And it was through my work, actually, my community work and working with other activists, that I discovered this little-known area of information restriction and just set about learning its structure and its mechanisms. And it's been a very interesting, often frustrating journey through the years. This structure has its own vocabulary. It has its own categories. It's deeply rooted and institutionalized. It's completely sort of subterranean, although with the advent of the internet, I think that we know a little bit more about the inner workings. So that's essentially how I came to the issue. And then when I started my doctoral program in the mid to late 90s, I revisited the topic and decided to actually study information seeking patterns with community activists and did some interviews with them. And that further broadened my perspective, because many of the activists that I interviewed were involved in what we would term as national security issues, you know, Citizens for Peace and Space, for instance, who are located in Colorado Springs, who work on space secrecy, that ill-defined area and category. So sort of peripheral to this, at this time, you know, I started making note of the language of the system so that I can further study it and understand the mechanisms. And so that led to my lexicon, which is now in the fourth edition and up at the Federation of American Scientists website. The exact title is On Their Own Terms. And essentially, it's not really a dictionary anymore. It's turned into an encyclopedia of terms that are most closely related to censorship, information restriction, and secrecy in the federal system. So, you know, all my projects are sort of closely linked together. So anyway, that's my background.
The focus of hearsay culture is technology is one aspect, intellectual property being the other. I noted with interest your background in library science, and we've had several librarians or people interested in library science on the show. Looking at this issue from the most obvious broad perspective, which is what the internet means for library science and how the internet is a form of a library and so forth. But none of those authors were focusing in the area of secrecy. So I'm curious, because of your background in library science, what draws you to what would be the opposite of information sharing, which is a secrecy doctrine?
Well, I think that, you know, boy, this is a complicated question. How much time do we have?
Oh, let's see. We have about another 45 minutes. I don't know if you want to take all of that time, but I may not stop.
Really a loaded question. You know, and it's sort of tied to why Dan and I did the book. Okay, so really, if one reviews the literature, you know, and I'm just not talking, you know, the book literature. I'm also talking the journal literature. You know, publicity / transparency is a pretty consistent phenomenon that's studied. But secrecy doesn't seem to be. And in fact, I really do believe that we should have a field, an academic scholarly field called secrecy studies. It's interdisciplinary, that we can sort of mine, you know, the research from other disciplines to sort of, you know, construct what is secrecy. And, you know, I think it's because of this dearth in the literature that, you know, that I just became fascinated with why aren't scholars, I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, I put the book together and we did have plenty of material. We also rejected plenty of material. You know, secrecy is being studied in the literature, but it's not studied in the same way as publicity and transparency is being portrayed. And so I think that, you know, long story short, one of the focuses of my work is to sort of bring secrecy studies to the forefront to say, hey, this is a field that is interdisciplinary, that can benefit from scholars' research in literature, you know, social sciences, political science, psychology, anthro, and let's try to bring this together and start to hash out some of these definitions and what we mean by secrecy and necessary secrets, for that matter.
You've raised an interesting point. I think it's a good way to start off our discussion because you've just drawn a distinction which may not be readily apparent to many listeners, which is that there is a difference between transparency and secrecy. Now, they would seem to me to be two sides of the same coin, but perhaps not. When we say secrecy, how is there a functional definition of secrecy or the kind of secrecy that you're referring to in this compendium that you prefer?
Well, you know, I'm going to be sort of a disagreeable guest right now.
Fair enough.
I don't think there is an adequate definition, and that's been one of the frustrations of my academic and activist career. I don't think there's a commonly held definition, as we pointed out in Chapter 1 of the book. And I think that, you know, there, again, getting back to this field, this proposed field of secrecy studies, this is one of the primary things this field has to do, or I hate to call it a field, but this, you know, scholarly inquiry needs to hash out is, you know, what is secrecy exactly? And, you know, one of the things we did in the book was present, you know, Cicero Bach's definition, which I believe off the top of my head is power and control over information. But I don't really think, Dave, that's a really adequate definition. And then, of course, you know, the great Edward Shields came up with his own definition based on his experience in the McCarthy era and with what we call atomic secrecy. And then, of course, Diane Vaughan, who's also included in the book, has done some wonderful work on the Challenger. She's proposed structural secrecy. Steve Aftergood, who I highly admire and has been very influential in my work. Hi, Steve. he has proposed several different kinds of secrecy. Political secrecy, I think bureaucratic secrecy, which may have its roots in Max Weber's work, and then national security secrecy, of which he mentions in his recent article in the Yale Journal of Law and Public Policy, I think. But, you know, there's all these definitions, and, you know, anyone who comes to the field will be automatically thrown off by the lack of definition and the language of secrecy. And so I think there's a lot of work here that needs to be done, a lot of work. And then there's another category called necessary secrets, you know, that Jan and I put forth in the book, you know, and that actually is based on Dennis Thompson's work on democratic secrecy and... you know, so all these things need to be fleshed out. What I plan to do, I teach at San Jose State University in the School of Library and Information Science, and I have taught a government secrecy class for about 3 years. This particular book, Government Secrecy, Classic and Contemporary Readings, came out of my course. In fact, I developed it as a textbook. And one of the things I think we're going to do in the fall is actually... flesh out a definition of secrecy. I've already developed a wiki, and we're going to just hash this out. And maybe, you know, we'll stick with the Bach definition, but maybe we'll come up with our own and, you know, publish an article on that. And I think that might be an interesting thing to do as a class project.
It's an area of personal interest to me, which is why we chatted a bit earlier before the show. At looking at this as something we could work on together would be of interest to me as well. When we think about secrecy, I mean, without an adequate definition, we can be a little broader, but we can drill down on how secrecy is used as a doctrine by governments. Where are we today? We can start right there. And I think there's an interesting focal point of your introductions to the various chapters, which I think is a good starting off point as we touch upon where we are today with secrecy. You reject the notion that all secrecy is bad. Now, I know from my own reading of literature in the transparency area, drawing that distinction, that there is a visceral reaction by many people in the scholarly community, as well as beyond that, where if a secret is being kept, it is A, for a nefarious reason, and B, it is against the public interest. And you reject that kind of bright line line drawing. So perhaps you could explain why you reject that bright line, and then I'll ask you another tough question, which is there a way to draw the line adequately?
Well, I was hoping you wouldn't ask me this particular question. It's out there.
We can come back to it if you'd like.
And I'll preface my comments with simply stating that I don't have everything worked out either on an academic level or a personal level in terms of necessary secrets. I'm still learning a lot about the intelligence community, also trying to flesh out a definition of national security and the application of national security concerns to secrecy. I think this is another poorly articulated position in the academic and also the military intelligence literature. But I will say that in my defense, a good characterization, but
this is not the O'Reilly factor.
Yeah.
So if you feel under pressure, that's certainly not my intention.
But I do think we can rely on again a reading from the text, which I highly encourage my students to think about, and just citizens at large to think about that that perhaps there are those conditions that warrant restriction of information. Now, that said, there's a reading that we included by Dennis Thompson, who's been very influential in my thinking. And he actually lays out in his article, different criteria for secret keeping. And, and perhaps, under certain conditions, like, let's say, I'm going back in time, I think Thompson refers to the Cuban Missile Crisis and a few other conditions where information may be restricted. But then he goes on in his article to actually say that, that there need to be specific criteria that are made public so the public knows that certain information is being restricted and they may know when that information will be released. We don't have anything like that really right now. When a person sits down to classify certain types of information, I don't believe that there's any kind of criteria that says in the year, 2050, this information will be released. I mean, there's the 25-year declassification rule, but that's probably, and of course, the Freedom of Information Act, which people could, do a mandatory declassification review. It's called an MDR. But there's no, sort of policy guidelines in place, as far as I know. And if there are, please email me. So I think that, Thompson's article is really right on in terms of, we should be really talking about this in the public sphere. What are those criteria? Now, the other person who's really been an advocate of this position is Steve Aftergood in his numerous writings. And I, we included one of his publications, Secrecy and Knowledge Production, which is an excellent overview of government secrecy and the issues. So there are those folks out there who, do advocate necessary secrets, but under certain conditions. And those conditions need to be publicly determined and transparent.
We're talking with Susan Merritt, one of the two editors of the compendium Government Secrecy, Classic and Contemporary Readings. Well, Susan, let me ask you a question which perhaps will not be quite as daunting as we're in a nebulous field, and I recognize that. But I guess I could use one of the things that I tell my students in law classes, which is there are very few right answers. So with that caveat to back away from the Bill O'Reilly method, which I apparently was using up until now, let me ask a question which I think it lends itself to some more direct discussion. Secrecy is an area that has become, I think, at least in my view, a little bit more front and center stage post 9/11. And as we're recording the show on July 13th, there's a recent news stories involving alleged assassination teams that former Vice President Dick Cheney had perhaps put together that weren't disclosed to Congress. And of course, we have a greater secrecy regime, and we'll talk about secrecy as regulation in a moment, post 9/11 that President Obama has at least said he would like to change, although the jury's still out on whether those changes are happening. Perhaps with that kind of background, perhaps I'll ask you this question. How does, in your view, secrecy as regulation, how does it exist today in 2009 versus, let's say, prior to September 11th? How important is secrecy, in your view, in current government operations?
Wow. This is such a great question, and this is how I would answer it completely. I'm interested in history, and if you've looked at the book, you know that Jan and I included a lot of historical, almost every article is just so richly detailed in terms of history and laying out the phenomenon. I think we have to understand that secrecy is part of the very fabric of American government, and it has been since the inception, you know, since the first days of the Continental Congress and even before in negotiations on the Declaration and that sort of thing. You know, you can't ignore this. And this is why we included, you know, Daniel Hoffman's excellent work on the Founding Fathers, because at least with my students, I want to really stress that, you know, this is not a new phenomenon. Now, that said, I think that, you know, and this, is, of course, has been in the literature, this isn't a new idea with me, that with the enactment and amending of the National Security Act of 1947, you see a further institutionalization of secrecy. And this is also where one sees, you know, certain agencies having power over information in terms of classification and, you know, the different information categories, security categories of top secret, secret, and confidential coming about. And so there's no doubt that we can say that, you know, the 1947 Act and its amendments had a profound effect on government secrecy. That said, the Atomic Energy Act did as well, because here you have this, I think it's a mind-blowing category. I still am so intellectually excited by it. It's called Bourne Classified. Mm. And if one goes to read the Atomic Energy Act, you know, which I've done many times and read about this category, this is essentially information that's censored from the very beginning. So, you know, it's an amazing concept. And one doesn't see this. I mean, it may have existed in some agency practice, but it wasn't actually institutionalized until the Atomic Energy Act. So it's phenomenal. And I would refer your listeners and my students, who will probably listen to this, to my lexicon where I lay out the whole history of the Bourne Classified concept. This is just amazing. And so then, you know, we have these periods of time where, you know, and these struggles for openness, you know, we've got the Moss Committee dealing with the Freedom of Information Act. We've got various congressional committees struggling to understand the intelligence community and surveillance and, you know, secrecy practices. And then, of course, we come to the Moynihan Commission that that actually studied the secrecy as a, well, what the Moynihan Commission actually said verbatim is secrecy is a form of government regulation. And this is, again, another mind-blowing concept or observation, I think, that, you know, Senator Moynihan was very influenced by Max Weber's, sociologist Max Weber's work on bureaucracy, and actually took this idea from Weber and made it into policy. And it's an amazing idea that, you know, we have parallel forms of government. You know, we've got on one side a government that really is committed to transparency and accountability, and then on the other side is completely secret and not so committed to accountability. So, you know, with the Moynihan Commission, and by the way, when we were talking about necessary secrets, I would really encourage your listeners and my students to go back and look at the Moynihan Commission, because the Moynihan Commission actually also validated the idea of necessary secrets, that there's some information that could be just so privileged and so hotly contested or strategic that it should be protected. So that's roughly, you know, the history of secrecy. Now, post 9/11, you know, this is one of the things that that I would like to write about and address someday in a future work, is are there patterns of secrecy? Because, you know, you see these certain patterns sort of, if one takes a look back historically, that during the Cold War we had incredible secrecy on both sides. It wasn't just the Americans, but it was, you know, the former Soviet Union as well, developed elaborate classifications and secrecy practices and information restriction to the public. And so when one looks back, one sees that, you know, during times of crisis, often, you know, these national security concerns and new types of information categories are created to further protect information. Leaks are also discussed and discouraged. I'm not trying to avoid your question, really, but I think we need to place 9/11 and the post 9/11 landscape within a broader historical context. And I'm not trying to evade anything at all. It's just that I think that, you know, there are these patterns, and it's important to look back. Now, that said, you know, we're living during this age, and we're all concerned citizens, and it's hard to, you know, emphasize accountability when one doesn't have the information. And certainly within the Bush administration, there is a whole level of secrecy that we hadn't seen in a very long time. In fact, we're still seeing it, like you mentioned, with the assassination teams.
Mm-hmm.
For the last 6 months, this is, you know, things are just starting to crack and melt, and so we're getting a little bit more information and insight into this administration. We probably won't know the whole story until we look at the presidential papers, until people start doing FOIAs, until the archivists get involved and start making these documents public. We simply won't have the whole story. But anyway, I hope I answered your question.
Well, given the nature of our discussion, I recognize that there's a vast amount of information to cover in a short amount of time, and I think after our short break here, well, we can drill down on a few more discrete topics, but I think you've oriented the listeners well. We're chatting with Dr. Susan Marrett, co-author of, or co-editor of the Compendium Government Secrecy, Classic and Contemporary Readings on Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you'd like to make a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can first email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And you will get a prompt response, or you can go to kzsu.stanford.edu, the website, and click on Donate to KZSU. Either way, in these lean times, I do hope you consider making a donation, but regardless, that you continue to listen to KZSU-FM Stanford. We're back after that short break. Susan, let's drill down on, again, a topic that is a focus of hearsay culture, which is the Internet. You know, the Internet itself, in terms of its actual infrastructure, is dumb. The Internet is merely a tool, and it's what we do with the Internet and how we use the technology that defines its parameters. And this is something, this of course is not a statement that I'm making original to me, but this is these are statements that come out of the work of Larry Lessig and J.B. Boyle and many others. But the Internet is a tool, obviously, of information sharing, and it's probably, if there is its defining characteristic in terms of certainly what its original designers intended, and what perhaps, at least in my view, its broadest, most idealistic aspirations could be, it is that information can be shared. Now, secrecy, at a very basic level, again, not asking for a definition, is the polar opposite of sharing information. When we think about the Internet itself, how does that change the secrecy playing field from a regulatory standpoint and from a practical standpoint? How do you see the Internet as it exists in 2009 changing the playing field in terms of secrecy as regulation? We can start there.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I have several different ideas and notions about it. I think, you know, more public participation has put greater pressure on the federal government and perhaps all governments to be more transparent and to engage. Just recently, OpenTheGovernment.org was, which is a public policy partnership of many, many different freedom of information groups, participated in the Obama's Openness Directive. I think it was called the Openness Directive. And so, you know, instead of writing public comment and sending it in, you know, in the days of yore, I mean, this was a great opportunity for people in real time to correspond with government agencies on, you know, what they would like to see in terms of transparency. So I think that, you know, the Internet has opened the door for more public debate, you know, in terms of transparency. The secrecy mechanism stayed the same. I mean, I just think that the web has, you know, opened the gate in terms of more dissemination of information. That said, maybe, you know, it's also giving the agencies a little bit more opportunity to put, you know, declassified documents on their site, and certainly, you know, people such as Russ Kick at Memory Hole to place FOIAs on the web that he's obtained from federal agencies. So it's a great participation tool, and you're right that it is totally geared for information sharing, and, you know, I'm very encouraged by that aspect of it, but I think we still need to understand secrecy in terms of the institutionalized mechanisms. I think that all citizens should really be concerned about the laws and the regulations that that prevent information from becoming public, and they really need to, you know, as part of their citizenship training, really do need to, you know, take a crash course in secrecy to understand those mechanisms. And then go back to the web and, you know, share their information. So that's how I see the web.
If we were able to put together a list, and I'm going to ask you to do that, but put together a list of how technology and more specifically the Internet has both helped and hindered secrecy, which way do you think ultimately it cuts? Because it, while clearly the Internet allows for greater sharing of information, and we've seen, you know, perhaps, certainly I think at this point, the most prominent and defining modern example of how the Internet has been able to break walls of secrecy very recently with the events in Iran, and how the Iranian government attempted to shut down all communication with the outside world and yet was unable to identify, apparently, Twitter as one of the applications that it should focus on, or perhaps it didn't have the wherewithal to do it. But at any rate, major news networks throughout the world were relying on tweets, literally, to report the news. At the same time, the Internet and technology has, by its very nature and its malleability, has allowed governments to control information. And while Twitter was working, various other sites were not, and search engines were being shut down. So the question becomes, ultimately, if, and I will push you a little bit on this, but again, recognizing that there are no right answers, would you say the Internet at the end of the day is overall, and its use, overall an engine of greater transparency, or do you see or envision the technology itself actually giving governments more control over information?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. Well, first of all, you know, when you were speaking, a thought came to my mind that I really do want to share is that when we were talking previously discussing, you know, definitions of secrecy, that one of the things that came to mind when you were talking was that, you know, censorship is directly related to secrecy. And again, you know, there's no, as far as I'm concerned, there's no adequate definition of secrecy. Any definition that I sort of project in my mind has a mention of censorship, and, you know, which is closely related to secrecy, and that really needs to be fleshed out, perhaps through case studies or, you know, scholarly panel, whatever. So I believe what you're talking about, if I understand your question directly, is the relationship between secrecy and censorship and
sure.
The ability of governments to control or impact communication.
Through the modern technological devices.
And I would say absolutely. You know, article19.org is working on this. There are other groups that are working on this. I think it's called freedominfo.org is also working on this. And issues, you know, regular reports by government on governments that are, you know, manipulating information. This has led me to sort of a secondary interest in the human rights area and the use of human rights of technology in the human rights arena, and you know, which is absolutely fascinating how community activists / citizens are using technology to encrypt data, to send data, to, you know, exploit data, to, you know, network with other activists and journalists around the world, the use of blogging to get information out to the global webosphere. There's no doubt in my mind that, you know, especially after reading reports on GhostNet, which has been the Chinese manipulation of Tibetan emails from the Dalai Lama's office. I don't know if you've read that report.
Yes, and Ron Deibert was on the show earlier in the year.
Right. And so, you know, activists, again, this goes back to my interest in human rights and technology. Activists are also having to become technologists and software engineers and cryptologists in order to protect their data. And there is software out there that actually encrypts information and, you know, sends it. It's called MARTIS. There's also different software packages, Tor, Vidalia, Freenet, those kinds of things that activists are using to protect their information. And so there's no doubt that technology and, you know, the openness of the web has really placed high demands on protection of information, and especially in countries that are potentially perceived as more repressive or are more repressive, you know, there's going to be this demand, you know, to protect information. I don't have any answers. I think everything is waiting to be determined here. We're just as information is being restricted, you know, I think people will find more ways to get it out there. You know, it's the wonderful thing about technology is there's always workarounds, it seems.
That's right. We're talking with Dr. Susan Merritt, one of the editors of Government Secrecy, A Classic Contemporary Readings, and I should have said at the beginning of the show that she is joining us by telephone from her home in Denver. When we think about these technological advances, perhaps I'll ask you a slightly different question, but related directly to government operations. You know, we see some fairly sophisticated activity, it seems, on the part of governments like Iran to attempt to shut down information flow. And yet, at the same time, we've seen governments really operate in a fairly inept way when it comes to using technology and harnessing it. And I'm not just talking about the fact that you could probably still go to state capitals and find computers that are 25 years old. But I'm talking more about general ability of governments to use technology to, again, create the secrecy regimes that they'd like to incorporate. Without asking you to survey all 50 states, I'll merely focus our attention perhaps on the federal government, because that is a focus of your book. How well do you think government is operating, or how competent do you think the federal government is to use technology to affect the secrecy regime that currently exists?
Well, you know, I think I'd like to address this as a former librarian, really.
Fair enough.
And probably a researcher. I've been very frustrated, both in my library practice and also, you know, my research, in terms of information not being digitized. You know, I think I would just like to bracket that for a second and just say, too, that maybe not all secrecy is intentional. You know, maybe some secrecy is enabled by what we call the gray literature, which is a fascinating phenomenon where essentially information isn't published through normal channels and it's considered gray. That would be, you know, you know, conference proceedings, meeting minutes, memorandums of understanding between agencies. You know, the list is goes on and on and on. And this gray literature, you know, it's not intentional secrecy. It's sort of secrecy by default. You know, this information sort of escapes the normal publishing routes. And so from my perspective, you know, the federal government has done, I think, a very poor job getting congressional hearings online. And I'm not talking about contemporary congressional hearings. I'm talking about congressional hearings back and back and back. This endeavor has been left to the private publishers. And unless one goes to an academic library, one can't find a digitized copy of these hearings. And these are essential to understanding secrecy and the history of government information restrictions. So that's been frustrating for me. You know, the EPA hasn't exactly put everything online either, and part of the gray literature are perhaps Superfund documents. You know, those don't normally go to, you know, local libraries. You know, and there's a wealth of information that's lost in those. And so, you know, I just have to sit here and say, well, you know, there's a lot to blame the federal government for, but we, you know, you sort of have to tease apart what, you know, the different strata, I think. And, you know, in terms of technology, I think certainly the government printing office could do a little bit more if they had adequate funding, you know, to digitize some of these materials. Certainly, you know, the agencies, if they had more funding, could declassify a little more quickly and get these documents online. You know, there's many different ways that we could sort of, you know, overcome this secrecy while also, you know, trying to hash out the criteria for what we call necessary secrets.
We, in our remaining 11 minutes or so, Susan, I think a topic that we could discuss, something we chatted about prior to going on air here, is the use of intellectual property law and governments and how governments have used intellectual property law to maintain secrets. And that's, as I mentioned at the beginning, and I mentioned a few times on the show, is an area of personal interest. What's your view there? I mean, ask the broadest question. You know, I write in how trade secrecy in particular is used by governments to either, you could put it one of two ways, either affect secrecy or defeat transparency. I need to look more deeply into the distinction that you're drawing here today. But how effectively do you think, again, just limiting our discussion to federal government for the time being, how effectively do you think governments are using intellectual property law to maintain their secrets?
Well, you know, this is, again, pretty complicated, and it's something that I think I placed a footnote in one of the chapters. Mm-hmm. You know, there are classified patents, and I think that this is something that a lot of people may not be aware of, that not all patents are transparent. There are those defense and or military patents that are classified and, you know, and aren't in the public PTO, Patent and Trademark Office databases. So that's one aspect of that. There's another aspect with biotechnology secrecy, and again, I use that term or that phrase lightly because that type of secrecy hasn't really been well-defined in the literature, but it is certainly related to patent and trademark secrecy. And confidential business information, which is totally enacted and enabled through the through TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, which allows for CBI information to be excluded from, let's say, ingredients or any kind of manufacturer labels. So there's different types of secrecy that are, well, for lack of a better phrase, goes back to the Moynihan Commission, that it's secrecy by regulation. These are not, you know, just ad hoc cultural practices. These are legitimized through law and regulation. And I truly believe, too, that Congress may not even know the different avenues that secrecy is enabled. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work to be done here, a lot of work.
The this area, again, is one that a number of scholars are focusing on. There's a book to which I'm contributing a chapter that will be coming out next year from Edward Elgar, focusing on trade secrecy, and my particular contribution is in this area. So I certainly share your interest in developing that field. Perhaps as we draw nearer to the end of our discussion, it would be good to, I think about secrecy as well from the standpoint of the recent activity by the Fed to boost the financial sector. Bloomberg, the news gathering entity, and others have brought FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, lawsuits against the Federal Reserve, seeking the Federal Reserve to disclose information involving the terms of loans made to the banks and so forth. And the Federal Reserve falls back, at least in the Bloomberg litigation, on various exceptions to the Freedom of Information Act that deal with keeping confidential information from the public. FOIA is you know, should be at least one of the primary avenues of investigative journalism and of investigative journalists. And yet, I've been surprised to see actually how underutilized FOIA seems to be by investigative journalists. And it seems like there's a lot more that could be done, even though it's time consuming and perhaps costly to certainly if you're going to go into court. How well do you think FOIA is working? Is it working particularly well from a secrecy standpoint, or would you say it's working particularly well from a transparency standpoint? Do you have an opinion there?
Well, I do have an opinion, and it's a pretty strong one. But it's based on my experience as a FOIA requester, being denied myself, and also teaching the Freedom of Information Act in my secrecy course. I just have to say, too, though, you know, there. I think it's IRE, I-R-E, Investigative Reporting something. I think that they, if your listeners, you know, do a search, they can find the organization. And I think also Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, both issue and monitor reports on how well FOIA is working. And actually, you can get that information from the DOJ website, and from the annual FOIA reports. Department of Justice actually issues those annual reports that list how many requests by agency and that sort of thing. There's a lot of detailed statistics there. I think FOIA is underutilized in certain communities. I think in the activist community, the concerned citizen community, I think those folks are pretty, they have more experience with FOIA than academics and Congress people and, you know, just about anybody. There's a wealth of information on the streets, and people are very, very willing to share their techniques and their language. So in certain communities, I think FOIA is very well represented. How well is it working? I think under the Bush administration, it didn't work very well with the card memo that essentially put the burden on the requester. Now we have, with the new Obama FOIA guidelines from DOJ, we have essentially, I think it's returned to the Clinton era, where agencies are more responsible to release. And so we shift. But that said, you know, there is a backlog. There are staffing issues, especially for documents that are highly classified. You know, there's the declassification process can take a very, very long time, you know, and there, so there are more procedural things that I think that could be streamlined, you know, by the agencies and, of course, probably better funding. But I think FOIA is a valuable tool, and I think everyone should be familiar with it. There are many different websites that have sample letters. A colleague of mine runs, I think, Grandpa's FBI file. I think that's what it's called. And it actually has a letter generator, which is kind of cool. And then there's also, you know, many agencies do have eFOIA online where, you know, you don't even really have to, you know, look at a stamp and in an envelope. You can just file online directly to the agency. And so I think people really do need to know how their government works. You know, we can't just vote anymore. We have to be active participants, and we have to know the system. And this is why Jan and I, compiled this book, to really get people thinking about secrecy, asking critical questions, and to really get to know the system so that they could be a participant, an active participant.
The book is Government Secrecy, Classic and Contemporary Readings. The co-editor is Susan Merritt. Susan, I'll ask you this last question, which doesn't focus on technology. It was kind of a broad thought question. But Bentham and others wrote about publicizing, the opposite of secrecy, as having an effect on public officials from a humiliation standpoint. The humiliation of revealing one's misdeeds or poor decisions or what have you will keep those people and decision makers in check so that good decisions are made and they behave ethically and so forth. And yet today, as you know, we survey the news, we see various elected officials, most prominently being the governor of South Carolina, Mark Sanford, and Senator Enzin from Nevada, and recently, but not right now, people like Eliot Spitzer, former governor of New York, and so forth, and former Senator John Edwards from North Carolina, who have behaved in ways which would seem to defy that theory, because they've acted in ways that are unethical or perhaps criminal and so forth, and have yet gone forward. Perhaps they stayed in office, perhaps they haven't. But it seems like that theory, at least in 2009, doesn't work too well. Or does it? Secrecy as a form of preventing humiliation, perhaps. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, until you posed that question to me, I hadn't really thought about it. I think political corruption is longstanding throughout human history, and when I think of Bentham, I mean, he's also the fellow who brought us the Panopticon,
Right.
I'm not so sure that humiliation works. I think, just from my reading of the literature, that, secrecy is something that that's possibly inherent in relationships, and for good reason, and of course with no good definition, it's hard to really flesh out the differences between confidentiality and privacy and secrecy, and that they're all related. I think I'd answer your question in a broader context of technology, that it's amazing that, we still have, investigative journalists who pursue stories, and, in the advent of the decline of the newspaper, we do have the blogosphere, and we do have many journalists and newspapers, adapting to this new technology we call the web and still breaking stories. And we need a strong press. It's one of the hallmarks of the United States that we have this this open press and freedom of information. I can't really speak to, how contemporary or relevant Bentham is to, this whole humiliation thing. I think that it's, politicians, seem to have ways, to hide information, and it's just up to the press and concerned citizens to try to combat that. It's not a contemporary issue by any means.
Right.
And it sort of reminds me of, I just watched the Frost-Nixon interviews, mm-hmm. the original ones with, and when you were asking the question, I actually reflected on Nixon's response, to many of the questions, and he didn't seem very embarrassed,
right.
just evasive. And so I think that this is maybe part of the political landscape, and the only way to combat it is, to be active.
Right.
And participatory.
The guest is Susan Merritt. The book is Government Secrecy, Classic and Contemporary Readings. Susan, for those people that want to learn more about you and your work, I know you blog. Perhaps you can offer that information.
I'd be glad to. Thanks for asking. Yeah, I do have several blogs, and one of them is, let me get that URL for you. I can hardly remember it. It's a WordPress blog, and it's bookofsecrets.wordpress.com. That's BKOF, and then the word secrets.wordpress.com. And I use that blog to, occasionally. It's hard to blog every day. I don't know how people do it. I admire those very
as do I.
Bloggers. But I use the blog to discuss different elements of the book and trying to come to terms with different types of secrecy, and there are numerous types, and just other things that come up in the news and anything that I want to comment on.
So again, the blog web address is?
Oh, it's book, bkofsecrets.wordpress.com.
Okay, BK.
Yeah, BK.
Okay, great. Susan, thank you so much for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I think this is such a broad area that I think having this book allows a lot of people to begin a discussion. And so I certainly invite you to come back on the show, perhaps to reflect publicly more on this issue for the benefit of our listeners. So I look forward to chatting with you again, and thank you again for joining us.
Well, thank you so much. You're a great host. Thanks.
I'm looking forward to a number of interesting guests coming up for the remaining shows in this quarter, including Kevin Bankston from the Electronic Frontier Foundation discussing his recent actions, lawsuits that where EFF is representing the plaintiffs against the government involving wiretapping and so forth. Jamie Boyle will be on the show discussing the public domain and his new book, which, again, relates to secrecy, the closing down the public domain. John Taranian from Chapman University will be on discussing his book, Whitewashed. Michael Heller from Columbia University School of Law will be on discussing his book, The Gridlock Economy, as well as a number of guests in the following quarter. We'll also have Professor Gordon Hall from University of North Carolina, Charlotte, who will be on discussing ethics in technology. For the fall quarter, which will begin in September, I'm looking forward to chatting with Siva Vaidyanathan from University of Virginia discussing his book, The Googleization of Everything, Kazis Varnelis and Geert Lovink, from both of whom are technology theorists residing in Europe, and I'm looking forward to chatting with them. Alex Halavay from Quinnipiac University discussing his book, Search Engine Society. Wendy Chun will be on the show discussing her books involving race, identity, and technology. Frank Pasquale from Seton Hall University School of Law and Danielle Citron from University of Maryland will be on discussing their work and some work I've been involved with involving fusion centers, which are interesting entities that have been put together with the encouragement of the Department of Justice. Tarleton Gillespie will be on from Cornell University discussing his recent work, as well as Annalee Newitz from Texploitation will be on the show discussing her work and her very interesting views on a variety of areas. Bobby Quall from DePaul University will be on discussing her theories of copyright law, as well as Jackie Lipton from Case Western Reserve University School of Law, disclaimer, my alma mater, discussing work that she's doing in technology and copyright. So a variety of guests coming on, both for the remaining summer quarter as well as the fall. As always, I'm interested in hearing your comments, suggestions, feedback, and so forth by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. You can access this show primarily, first and foremost, by listening to KZSU-FM Stanford at 5 o'clock Pacific time on Wednesdays, where you can hear the show first, and then it is posted as a podcast. You can get that at hearsayculture.com, where you can listen to all of the previous shows and see the upcoming schedule and read my occasional blogging, as well as picking up the show through iTunes by going to the Stanford Center for Internet Society page in iTunes. You can also go to CIS's webpage, cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And last but not least, you can also pick up the show, again, by going to KZSU. And I encourage you to do it that way, if at all possible. Thanks for listening to Hearsay Culture today. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.